meeting to order. All please rise. Let me salute to our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. You may be seated. Our clerk will now take the roll call.
Councilmember Hanson?
Here.
Councilmember Ingram?
Here.
Councilmember Muckler?
Here.
Councilmember Goodrich?
Here.
Councilperson Zimmerman and Councilperson Malpezzi have other items to address, and they asked to be reclused from tonight's meeting, so I entertain a motion.
I'll move to excuse Councilmember Zimmerman and Malpezzi.
I'll second it.
Okay, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries 4-0. That'd be an interesting number. Okay, next up is the public comment period. This is on anything that's not on tonight's agenda, so if you want to talk on anything else that's on the agenda, the Main Street switch off, the contract, the public hearing on water sewer, the flood ordinance, that will come later. So this is anything that's not on tonight's agenda. You can approach the council and talk about anything live. You can sing, you can tap dance. You got excited. Are you a tap dancer?
We could
tap dance on carpet. So anyone on tonight's agenda doesn't want to talk anything open? No? None? All right. We'll move forward. Council, I entertain the consent agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, moving second for the consent agenda. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 4-0. Okay, this next up is a public hearing on the flood ordinance revision, and we welcome our planning director, Mr. Yuri Burnett. Welcome, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, Council. This is a public hearing for you tonight. In 2009, the National Marine Fisheries Service filed a lawsuit against Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, alleging that FEMA had not successfully protected endangered species within Region X of the FEMA area, which is basically Puget Sound. What National Marine Fisheries Service stated was that the FEMA protections for floodplain were basically intended to protect property, to protect the construction of buildings so that they were at least 1 foot above flood elevation, but had done little, if anything, to protect endangered species, and that development within this area had contributed to those species being increasingly stressed. As a response to that biological opinion, FEMA was directed to come up with policies that could be enacted by the various jurisdictions up and down the Puget Sound region in order to protect endangered species. They came up with a model ordinance last year and required, I'm sorry, it was early last year, and at that time required that all of the agencies that were subject to it adopt regulations in September 2010. There was a lot of pushback to that, and they delayed it to September 2011. Basically, what the model ordinance would do would identify something called a riparian habitat zone, which is that area where there is sensitive habitat influenced by the river or rivers, a channel migration zone, which is the area that the river could migrate over time, and, of course, the floodway zone, which is a more protected area within the floodplain, where you actually have velocity from flood. The various jurisdictions that are subject to this requirement have three options, really. Adopt the model ordinance as written, which is door one. Door two is to adopt elements of that ordinance, but be able to demonstrate that either existing policies or site conditions are such that the model ordinance doesn't need to comply. Or third, do a development-by-development habitat assessment, basically a second SEPA EIS, for every development within the floodplain. So as the city started to look at the model ordinance, we quickly determined that the model ordinance was designed in many ways for areas that are not urban in nature, for the remainder of the river area where you do have rural elements, you have untouched natural elements, and you also have a very more constrained floodway area. whereas you look at our unique circumstances, and we have an armored bank along the west side of the Nooksack River. We also have a very extensive floodway already. So we propose going through door two, which is being able to demonstrate that our conditions and our existing policies are in place that would make full adoption of the model ordinance unnecessary. We presented that to FEMA, and we submitted the map that's on page 54, basically identifying where we believe that our riparian habitat zone is and where the channel migration zone is when compared to the floodway. FEMA responded by saying that they agreed with the city that because we have such a broad floodway, the channel migration zone and the riparian habitat zone are already within an area that we don't allow development in the first place. They further agreed that since we had armored the bank many years ago, new development on the landward side was not likely to impact a riparian habitat zone that hasn't been in place in my lifetime. So they felt comfortable with this approach. It would make a variety of changes to our floodplain regulations. It would not prevent development by any means, but would in some cases require a little bit additional review on the city's part or the applicant's part. Compared to what could have been, it is not a significant change. It does not downzone areas, which many other jurisdictions have experienced. And I guess partway to conclusion, FEMA said that we were one of only three jurisdictions that has so far been able to go this road. Most of the other jurisdictions are either looking forward to battling it in court or adopting a model ordinance. So we're recommending that you adopt this ordinance. The changes are not major. The city dodged a bullet, I guess you could say, because downtown will still be able to be developed. I would point out one additional change. We do make reference in the ordinance to stormwater development or stormwater plans within the floodplain. The requirement of the ordinance states that development in a floodplain will use low-impact development technologies, rain gardens, so on and so forth. But it doesn't really describe exactly what those are. So we are recommending that the language in that section, and I can find it for you if the city clerk requires it, but that particular section, we can get it later, would be replaced by saying stormwater in the floodplain must incorporate low-impact development techniques per LID Technical Guidance Manual for Puget Sound, January 2005, revised May 2005, and including future amendments in accord with the Department of Ecology Stormwater Management Manual for Western Washington, current edition. What that change would do is rather than just saying low-impact development, which everyone can grab their own definitions for it, it's tying it to a specific regulation and allowing for changes as it goes forward. So we're all on the same page with the development community. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from council first. Councilperson Mutchler.
So in a practical sense, the down zoning that could have occurred actually already occurred decades ago here. We basically down zoned this land before, so we're not having to do it now. And then you also mentioned that it doesn't stop development, but it brings some development for review, right?
Yes.
And what could be a worst case scenario, worst case in terms of a developer owner? That he might have to do. You mentioned some of the low impact thing. What could happen to a property owner?
Well, for example, one of the things that it is looking at is making sure that the flood attenuation capacity of the Nooksack River, basically the bowl that the Nooksack River can go to when it floods, is not reduced by new development. So if there was a case, not necessarily in a downtown, but in other areas where development were to come in and need to bring in fill in order to get above a base flood elevation, they would need to either replace the fill that they put in by digging an equivalent.
Don't they already have to do that before this?
We have a policy in place that says east of Interstate 5, they do. This would make it for all of the floodplain.
Which is why we recently had that discussion about the large property owner and what he's going to do.
and that they would either need to do that, which is the older technology, or demonstrate using best management practices that they are able to keep the flood attenuation capacity the same, similar to what the folks down at Ferndale Center did.
And then finally, National Fisheries found that FEMA was negligent in some way. Just the Puget Sound area? Why just this area?
That was what they were looking at in particular. I think because we do have the salmonoid species that are going up.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions, Council, to Fiore? No? Seeing none? Okay, I'll open up the public hearing portion. And this will be the same description. We'll also have a public hearing on the water sewer fee incentive right after this. So my description of a public hearing will apply for two items. A public hearing is a formal opportunity to give testimony to the council for consideration in the decision-making process. If you intend to speak, as necessary, you sign in the sign-up sheet. That's not necessary here. We'll call on you. I have one person on the second hearing, but if you want to talk, we'll open it up to the audience. Written comments may also be submitted to the city clerk prior to the beginning of the hearing. When the mayor calls your name, proceed as follows. Proceed to the speaker's rostrum right there. The microphone, clearly state your name and address. If you are speaking as representative for another person or organization, so state. State whether you're a proponent, opponent, or neither. Limit your comments to 3 minutes after all comments are heard. If you have something to add that has not already been stated, at the discretion of the mayor, you may be given an additional 2 minutes. There will be no demonstration during or at the conclusion of anyone's presentation. During public testimony period of the public hearing, the council, staff, and audience will remain silent. After your presentation, council members may wish to ask you questions. After the last person has spoken, the hearing will be closed and the council will enter a regular session. The subject of the hearing will usually appear as an agenda item for council discussion. These rules are intended to promote an orderly system of holding a public hearing and to give every person an opportunity to be heard and ensure that no individuals are embarrassed by exercising the right to free speech. So I'll open the public hearing portion, and this is on the flood ordinance revision that was just described by our planning director. Would anyone like to speak on that subject? Exciting subject. Everybody's jumping up. Okay, going, gone. I'll close the public hearing portion, and comments from council can continue on. Councilperson Mutchler?
Yeah, Mayor. I move the adoption of Agenda Bill 1108005 with the letter B door, whatever that was called, choice.
With recommendations as by staff?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Further discussion? Seeing none. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
What was behind door number C?
4-0. Okay, next one is the public hearing on the water sewer fee incentive.
Okay.
Welcome again, Mr. Burnett.
Thank you. The city staff is proposing that council adopt a development, well, not a development incentive, a connection fee incentive to property owners with existing development within the city of Ferndale who are currently connected to on-site septic systems. The proposal would be that those folks would be able to get 80% discount off of their normal sewer connection fees, and if they need to hook up to public water as well, 80% off of their water fees, as provided that they do make a connection or set up for making a connection within 2 years of the effective date of this ordinance. There are a number of reasons why we are proposing this. Number one, septic systems were not designed to last in perpetuity, and we have seen recently and really continuously that septic systems do fail, especially when they are not adequately maintained. But sometimes even when they are adequately maintained, they do fail, and sometimes they fail catastrophically so that they will put the property owner in a position of needing to find a new place to dispose of their wastes within a matter of hours. Sometimes they will need to spend not only thousands of dollars, but tens of thousands of dollars, depending on the site conditions, to replace it. Sometimes when a septic fails, even if it doesn't fail, it might start leaching out into the groundwater, into the ground system, becomes more of a concern as the city is moving towards well supply, and we're going to be getting our drinking water out of that same dirt. But up to this point, there has been no incentive for making that change. The property owners are generally looking at about $10,000 in connection fees, plus an additional $10,000 or sometimes more in actually bringing the lines out to their site. So what has happened is people have waited until their septic fails and then try to scramble to find financing, try to scramble to find a contractor who can take it out. This, for the first time, the city would be asking people to proactively plan to replace their septics and giving them a major incentive to do that. Also, by keeping it within a two-year window, we're allowing the potential so that if one neighbor wishes to convert, possibly his neighbor is also in the same situation, and they could share the costs of that infrastructure installation. So it might be that a $10,000 installation cost goes down to $5,000 for each one of them. Again, another substantial savings. Another reason why the city is considering this is we know that there's at least one and probably more manufactured or mobile home parks that are on a group septic. So in this case, the Ferndale Mobile Village off of Douglas has between 40 and 50 units all on septic, and they are wanting to convert them to public sewer for the reasons that I've just listed. In addition, there's a large land area on their property that they can't really use. For 50 units, the cost is approximately $500,000 in connection fees. Plus, they have estimated about another $500,000 for the infrastructure costs to bring the lines up and connect to each of those 40 to 50 units. So a $1 million price tag on a facility that is generally low to mid-income is cost prohibitive and may not take place unless there is an emergency. Only by reducing the connection fees can we get that, and so it is financially feasible for these units. We cannot provide them discounts on the cost of actually installing the infrastructure, of course. In order to keep it fair, it's appropriate to extend the same incentive to not only this particular development, but to all developments, large or small, residential developments that are subject to the same regulation. So with that, I think that response to it, I would point out that this does apply to folks who are on septic. If they are just on well water but connected to city sewer, the few that may be in that circumstance, or if they're on an association, it would not apply to them. They must have septic and be converting that to public sewer.
Okay, first up is Councilperson Mutchler.
I just wanted to be very clear that if a person's septic system goes out, they can't replace it. They have to hook up. If a septic system fails, they can't say, who in the city, figure of speech, I guess, but I'm going to rebuild my septic system. They have to hook up. So it's logical that every, and there's about 800 of these customers, are going to have to hook up someday.
Yes, that is our belief, you must, in order to build in the city, hook up to sewer.
Okay. Well, I like this. I understand this came from Mr. Peterson, I think, originally.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I think this is a great idea. I personally wish it was a little longer period of time. I'd like to recommend maybe a council might go to 30 months. Just 2 years flies by real fast, and the kind of money needed for the infrastructure is a substantial amount of money. So I'm in favor of this, but I wish it was a little bit longer period of time.
When we had talked about that, we can always extend it, but one of the reasons for having a relatively tight timeline was knowing human nature. If we go further out in the horizon, people are usually going to start planning with 6 months to go or so. Council could certainly do that, but we would recommend that you establish the 2 years, and if necessary, closer to that time, then consider extending.
And we would include notices, maybe several in the water sewer bills as they're going out to
water, particular, most especially.
Councilperson Ingram.
I think John covered it. I was just going to ask Yori to make the statement as to how many customers we have currently on septic systems within the city limits, and it's about 800.
Yes, Mark Peterson, and that does not include anyone that is not hooked up to either one. Those are 800 units, more individuals than that more than likely, that currently get water but not sewer from the city.
Councilperson Hansen?
Just a couple of quick clarifications. This is not available to people who live actually outside the city.
Correct.
The other clarification is I'm on well water, or I'm on association water, I'm on a septic tank, I'm inside the city limits. Do I get to take this discount on sewer only and continue with my well water, if water is available? Situations where it's not available, i.e. the central city water, it technically is not available to the city water is not available to those customers. And, of course, those customers are all now on sewer, I believe. But I do have a couple of neighbors of mine who have association water. City water is available. If they chose to put the infrastructure in and go to city sewer, would we require them to also go to water?
Our public works director, I think, can answer that better than.
Yeah, Yori, I'm not sure on your ordinance. Did you address that? That scenario may not have been included in there.
We addressed sewer connections. We do have it in there.
Why would you discriminate?
Yeah,
I don't see any logical reason why you're discriminating.
I would think, given the public health aspect of sewer.
Well, because we have city ordinance that says that you can't hook up the sewer without also hooking up the water. That's the way it stands today.
Yeah, I'm not seeing, in this case, because it's a two-year incentive, conversion, 30-month incentive, I'm not seeing any logical reason why you'd make that statement.
Why we wouldn't want to do that.
Why they wouldn't want to hook up the water?
No, sewer only.
No, why would we not? Why would the city not want to have them hook up to sewer?
Well, you have no control, unless they're a member of an organized water association. You have no control over your sewer is charged by the amount of water you use.
Yeah, you'd have to have maybe a flat rate system.
Yeah.
Yeah. You
have to have flat rate billing system.
I don't care one way or the other. I'm just stating that this question undoubtedly will come up because there's probably one or two customers out there that...
Yeah, I think it's legitimate. We'd have to flat rate billing system. But the end result is still the same. For health reasons, you want them off septic and on the sewer. We didn't actually go into that specific.
No, we do provide, if they do switch both over, that they both get 80% discount. But if they only go from septic to sewer but remain on public water, I would assume that part of it is making sure that what you inject into it is
good. You want to research, because I believe there is an ordinance on the books that essentially says if you're hooking up to one, water and or sewer, and the other one is available, you must hook up to both.
Councilman Ingram?
And the committee... Mark specifically addressed the flat rate sewer billing system, and so it's very much on his mind.
Mm-hmm. One of the on the top of page 68, we have not changed this, but it's the existing city policy. Might answer part of it, but not all of it. Where both water and sewer main lines are available within 200 feet of a property, connection to the sewer system shall not be allowed unless the property shall also utilize city water service.
If available.
That essentially answers it.
I would answer
it,
yeah.
Councilperson Mutchler?
So then if I heard you correctly, they have to hook up both. And so should we apply the discount to both so they'll...
It would be applied to both.
Yes.
And then the question I had is... How many citizens do we have that have no sewer water, city water and sewer, and how do we communicate to them this opportunity?
Much more difficult to measure. I think that one of the primary ways is the media, Facebook. There are few ways to single everybody out to know that we've hit everybody that's not. One thing that we talked to Mark about is the ability to utilize GIS and to cross-reference GIS, our mapping system, on our water customers and sewer customers, and basically then identify which areas are not included.
Seems like we have a list of all of our tax property tax payers, and then we know who has sewer. We just take who is left over somehow, database thing.
We have to do that by hand.
Can't be that many.
No. Yeah.
It
can't be
that many. Ms. Ratter just mentioned that the health department has records of all of our the septic tanks, so that might be.
But we would want to let them know, maybe twice.
Okay, any other questions or comments from council? Okay, I'll open up the public hearing part. I have one person signed up, and then we'll take that person. Anyone else that wants to speak will have to do that. So I have a Jay Irwin. Welcome, sir.
Hi, thanks for allowing me to speak. Jay Irwin, I'm at 214 North Commercial Street in Bellingham. I'm a land use consultant. I've been working with some clients of mine, Duke Development, who have some property in the urban growth area, North Church Road. I'd like to speak in favor of the proposal, but I would ask that consideration be given for sewer connections in the urban growth area as well, as the comprehensive plan does make it, it gives it an allowance, but it is there an exception there for failing or threats to human health in that case. I have been in discussion with the neighbors around my client's property, and, you know, I don't know if they're failing or not, but certainly the fees have been a consideration, and given the timeline, given the two-year timeline, it is a longer-term proposal that my clients are looking at eventually petitioning for annexation. But I think in the meantime, if there are failing systems, I think it's something that my clients could work with to get those, to get any failing systems out of that drainage area and the public utilities in place for eventual annexation.
Questions for Mr. Irwin? Mr. Goodrich?
No, I was going to ask Yori kind of a follow-up question on that, is why can't we or why don't we do this to the UGA?
Well, in the proposed ordinance, once they got annexed, those properties would have 2 years, and they'd be able to have that same incentive at that time. I think to Mr. Irwin's point, his clients would rather not have to risk having their septic fail in the interim and get the connections out there. From staff's perspective, it puts us in a little bit of an awkward situation similar to the Erickson property, where we now have a property which is connected to public water and sewer, and that might be all that that property owner ultimately wants. They might not want to subdivide, and there's very little that the city can do. No protest agreements have been good until someone protests. So it could be that the city extends public water and sewer, and then they decide not to move forward with an annexation. That would be, I think.
Well, I thought we'd offer that service now to somebody in the UGA if their septic is failing and we have nearby. I don't understand why we wouldn't extend this to the UGA people, because they're in the same situation. We would like them off of their septic systems and onto sewer, whether or not they're part of the city today or not. But if in 2 years their system fails, the property he has there, we're going to be extending the service to them anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's – does council feel that it is appropriate, that this serves a broad enough public purpose where the risk of the health emergency is treated the same way as an actual health emergency?
So Mr. Irwin doesn't have to stand up. Or will you have any questions for Mr. Irwin, or is it a general discussion?
Same discussion topic that he's brought up.
I was just going to comment on exactly the same discussion.
Okay, so Mr. Irwin, you can sit down, and if we need you, we'll bring you back up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Okay, first up was Councilperson Hanson.
Do you want to continue the public hearing if there's anyone else that wants to speak first?
Yeah, because that's a pretty big subject. Yeah, okay, let's do that. So anyone else in the audience would like to speak about the septic issue? Now's your time. Love to hear from you. No problem. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. My name is Glenn Peterson. I'm 5981 Church Road, up on the hill here. I've heard about this through the paper. I don't know what your sewer charges are. I have, in the past, and under the new additions up there, brought in, across it, put a new blacktop through. Went ahead in the future thinking, you know, I'd hook up with the city. But to this day, I don't know what you charge. There was nothing in the paper but on your meeting what this fee was going to be or what's going to be in the future. At the present time, of course, I have a septic tank system. I'm by myself in my home. And I'm not in any trouble by any means because I have about approximately 2 acres and a distance away. I would like, before we get too far, how much is this going to cost?
That's a good point.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Talked about
Thank
the
you.
Connection fees. But we haven't talked about
okay. Fees. Anyone else from the audience would like to comment on the septic issue? Okay. Seeing none, let's start back the discussion. I'll go with my order is Hansen, Ingram, Young. Back to much. So, Councilperson Hansen.
Well, I'm going to speak to the issue of hookups outside of the city limits, and we have a number of them throughout the community. It is a 50% surcharge, number one. And to answer this gentleman's question, if you're outside of the city limits today, it's approximately $10,000 to $12,000 to hook up to water and sewer both. If you, I believe the Ericssons, because they hooked up outside of the city limits, paid around $18,000 for hookups. Had this scenario been in place, because I don't know what you're, if you're allowing this outside of the city limits, then I guess it would be 80% of 1.5 times the water, so 80% of 18,000 as opposed to 80% of 12,000. What I really wanted to do is speak to the fact that you're opening up a huge can of worms if you start extending services outside of the city limits. We have been handling it on an emergency basis, on a case-by-case basis, but there is no incentive, and there are people out in, currently in the North Bellingham area that fought like crazy to get out of the urban growth so that they didn't have to ever worry about coming into the city, but they still want our service, and they are hooked up, many of them, to our service. And I'm fundamentally, personally opposed to a carte blanche. Anybody outside the city limits can benefit by this. I don't think we should hook them up if they're outside of the city limits. If they're contiguous, annex. That's the way people get city services. And so that's my opinion. I believe that we should not be hooking people up outside of the city limits except on a case-by-case basis, which has been the policy here for a long time.
Okay. Councilman Ingram?
And basically along that same line, there's a lot of our urban growth area, if I'm not mistaken, that we don't have those services available currently. I don't think our city water and our city sewer go past Stonyfield Bridge, that last development along Church Road. It stops right there. So to extend it out to near Alder Grove, or that would be, if we can get a couple of citizens to pay for that for us, I'd probably be willing to let them hook up, because that would save us a couple of million dollars right there. But some areas where those are just not available, and no matter how badly a person needs his septic system replaced and hooked up, and if we haven't got the service to give it to him, he's got to find another solution.
Now, an important note to remember is, in our urban growth, you can repair your septic system. Mm-hmm. You have the ability to repair. Inside the city limits, you don't. In the urban growth, that regulation doesn't apply. You can repair your septic system, new sewer system.
And most lands out there are about 5 acres, are they not?
Well, I don't know if I can consistently say
two,
that.
Two and a half, five, something like that. Big enough to put another septic system.
City Administrator Greg Young.
Not really much more to say. Councilmember Hansen really said it. I think water sewer is probably the biggest incentive for folks to annex. And I think supplying that would take away any incentives.
Councilperson Mutchler?
I like the idea. Can we add the 2-year window to annex areas? for the sewer, and somehow instead of waiting for that to happen, so that people, because they could stay forever on their sewer. And we do want them to convert from septic to sewer, regardless of when they get in.
So upon annexation, there'd be a 24-month window?
For people in the annexation.
But in 1320-100, page 68, number 4, properties with existing septic systems that are annexed into the city of Ferndale and that are within 200 feet of existing sewer lines shall be eligible for discounts described in B above for a period of 2 years after the property has been annexed. If properties are annexed and sewer lines are not available within 200 feet, three above shall apply. And three above says when it comes within 200 feet.
So you've got it.
Then you have 2 years, yes. The other thing that I would add just to the water and sewer conversation, Whatcom County has established zoning designations of UR4 there. You get 4 units per acre in our unincorporated urban growth area if public water and sewer is available. What the county basically does when subdivision requests come in is verify that you are, in fact, connected to public water and sewer. This could be the case there where someone gets public water and sewer, can get 4 units per acre out in the county, and does not need to actually annex. So that's not something the city wants.
Yeah, I'd like to move the approval of Agenda Bill 1108-006 as presented. As is.
I'll second that.
Okay, moving to second. Further discussion? Seeing none. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 4-0.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up. Maybe people want to talk about this one. So the Main Street traffic issue.
No.
I did. That's right, I did.
Oh, Marcy's contract.
That's right. Okay, I'm gonna go to our city clerk, and he'll explain the issue on that.
Council, before you use the contract with Marcy Cool, who the hiring panel selected as her top choice for the payroll and deputy city clerk position, Marcy would replace Sylvia Stiles, who is the longest-serving city employee, more than 27 years now, who will be very, very greatly missed by everyone in the city, but most especially me. She leaves on September 30th. This contract for Marcy would begin on August 29th. By doing that, it would allow her 5 weeks to work with Sylvia prior to Sylvia leaving. It's about the longest time we felt we could fit for them to work together. Marcy previously worked for the city for about a decade and left employment here in 2004 to focus on her family. She now is ready to come back to the workforce. Her children are a little bit more grown up and is very excited to come back. We're very excited to have her back, should you approve this. We received a total of 184 applications for this position. We went through all of them. It was very difficult to make this selection. The qualifications for this job are pretty specific, because most especially because of the payroll function. We really needed someone with payroll experience. Marcy formerly was the backup for payroll here at the City of Ferndale. We also were hoping to find someone with governmental experience as well, and obviously Marcy has that. If you need any other detail, you can ask me.
Councilperson Goodrich?
Why does the contract end on December 31st of this year?
The contract ends on December 31st because all contracts are annually based, and so the intention was to have this contract then match the rest of the contracted employees' period. So we would renew it. The intention is obviously to keep her on board and renew it January 1st along with everyone else.
Okay. And this is a union position?
It is not union.
It's not union.
Correct.
Okay.
That's why it's contracted.
Okay. Councilperson Metzler?
Yeah, I move the approval of the contract for Marcy.
I'll second.
We move and second. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries 4-0. Okay, next up, Main Street traffic. We'll start with our city administrator, and then we'll go to Public Works.
Right. As I believe most everyone is aware, there was a video that was circulated recently showing a city over in England that through really just serendipitous, their traffic lights literally failed. And they noticed that when they failed rather catastrophically, traffic improved rather dramatically. And that gave them the idea to try it on a trial basis, which they did, and then eventually they they took them out altogether, and there's been a rather dramatic increase in the mobility in the city. That idea got us to thinking, well, if it worked there, perhaps it might work here. We and our public works director will speak more to this here in a moment, but as is the case with most issues of human nature, it always tends to be a little bit more involved than originally thought. So you'll be hearing the issues that have come up mostly from a traffic engineering standpoint. In fact, I'll just kind of preface it by saying I did pass out an aerial photograph of Putting's Head, the name of the city over in England. And there's a few physical geometric aspects of this that contrast to our Main Street area. If you look at the map, you can see that the streets that intersect the main line come in at a rather of an acute angle rather than a 90-degree angle that we have downtown. There's also, if you're looking at the photograph with the white on the bottom right, you can see that there's two parallel roads. That's actually a couplet where it's two lanes one way in one direction and two lanes one way in the other direction, which again helps to separate traffic and you have less conflicting turning movements. Other than the fact that they drive on the left side of the road, naturally the conflicts over there would be opposite ours when we drive on the right-hand side. We would like to continue to explore this concept, talking with our insurance agent, AWC. They are generally on board as long as the engineering aspects would be forthcoming. We've talked with our police force, and they are generally supportive, assuming that the rules of the road can be rather clear as far as if there was to ever be an accident. Who had the declared right-of-way and what have you. The issue really does appear to be more in the area of traffic engineering and the rather rigid American rules when it comes to traffic controls with the areas of pedestrians as well. With that, I guess I turn it over to our Public Works Director, Janice Marlega. We've been talking with Transpo, our traffic engineers, and I think there's some interesting, perhaps, variations off the theme that we would like to pursue a little bit further.
All right, and we've also had some discussions with Bob Herman, and he's the traffic engineer that helped us out on at Washington and Vista. And so they brought up, some really good points for us to consider. But I'd first like to just, thank the City Council for at least for us, having the discussion and for you at least, considering and talking about this, because otherwise, if you weren't willing to have the discussion, we would be way behind, even like on the roundabouts, because there were a lot of people that were opposed to those roundabouts when they first came out, and now they're all over. And Public Works were definitely in favor of improving traffic flow along Main Street, and so an idea comes along, we definitely want to take a look at it and see if there's maybe not the entire plan, but maybe a piece of it that we could use. And just recently, we collected new turning movement counts at the intersections of 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And the City of Bellingham was able to make a few adjustments to the signal. And actually, the level of service at Main and 4th, they were able to improve that level of service from a B to an A. So we are trying to be, very proactive and, make positive changes for the traffic flow through Main Street. Some of the things, though, that we, public safety is our number one concern, so we need to make sure that all safety issues are addressed before making any changes to the signals, timing as far as turning, any off. And so public safety, number one. And some of the things we need to take a closer look at are, sight distance, because along Main Street we have the buildings that are just, right out there. There's not a lot of room from the back of the sidewalk to the buildings. So we need to definitely take a very close look at sight distance at each one of those intersections. And then just the balance of the traffic volumes. I mean, we know that the majority of the traffic is on the through street, on Main Street. But at different times, we may have higher volumes maybe at 2nd. So there could be, some different options that we could look at a couple of the intersections. Also, there's the right-of-way issue. If we had, we turned off the lights, you know, who actually has the right-of-way. So we need to look into that pretty thoroughly. And then there's also there's public notification requirements that we need to meet. And so we just need to make sure we've looked into this thoroughly before, you know, taking any or making any changes at this time.
I guess I'd add, too, that another issue that we've talked with our traffic engineers is naturally pedestrian safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's something that they're going to be addressing. What we're actually proposing at this point is since Transpo has all of our current turning movements and traffic volumes because of the planned action EIS that we're completing, and because they, through our traffic impact fees, have the model, the computer model built for the city, they are willing to just run some quick scenarios of various traffic configurations at various times of the day to see what, according to the computer model, what might happen with traffic. So at this point, we're not asking you to approve that we move this forward. We would rather just spend a little bit more time on the engineering side of it and then come back with what we found from our experts so we can perhaps have a little more thorough and thought out process that, as Ms. Marlega said, we might end up not simply shutting them off, but we might come up with some variance in certain situations that could indeed, on a trial basis, serve to increase traffic.
Councilperson Goodrich is first. This weekend I did some kind of observations. I spent from 4 o'clock till 5:30 on the bridge, and as I was waving to people, I was looking at the traffic as it was going by, and I noticed your big rig problem at Hovander, because all of a sudden no cars started coming by, and I thought, what the heck, where'd all the cars go? And all of a sudden I saw a FedEx truck trying to make the turn, and he had blocked everything, but that's another issue. What I noticed in that time from 4 to 5:30 that I was there, that when the traffic started backing up on the bridge, it was because the signal at either first or second had turned red. And so I was looking at it, and I think, why was it? It was left-hand people making left-hand turns for the most part, coming off of Vista on the second and then making a left-hand turn on the main. And I was thinking, why don't we eliminate on First Street and 2nd Street, put a sign up there that a lot of cities do, no left turn from 4 to 6 p.m. So if you're on 2nd Avenue, you can go straight or you can go right, but you can't trip the signal to turn left there. And I think that would open up a lot of the flow there, because by the time you get down to 3rd Street, a lot of cars have already peeled off. And if we could train people to use 3rd and 4th, especially 4th, to come off of Vista on into Main Street and make your left turn at 4th Street, you'd have less of an impact. And so I know for sure 1st and 2nd, possibly 3rd, of putting up a sign, no left turn from 4 to 6 p.m. on both the north and southbound lanes, that may eliminate the signals tripping and therefore keeping the cars flowing through. So those are just kind of the observation that I have. And then the other thing I was looking at is the sight distance that was brought up. When I was at 3rd and Main coming off of Vista there, when I stopped back on where you're legally supposed to stop, you know, there, you can't see hardly either direction on Main Street. So you really have to nose your way out to get past the buildings and then past the parked cars, because there was a big pickup truck parked there so that you could actually see, you know, on Main Street. So I don't think this turning off the signal thing would work just because of the sight visibility issue that's kind of inherent there. So those are just kind of some of the observations I had from Friday and Saturday. Okay. Councilperson Hansen's next.
What? My mind is not. Oh, are you?
No,
you
he beats it. Microphone, please.
I was going to say my mind's not totally closed to this. But it's not open very much. The problems that are inherent with it, and the traffic study is going to solve that. Not necessarily solve it. We'll point those out to you. We're having an awful lot of trouble right now with people trying to cross in the crosswalks with traffic turning onto the street and say, well, I've got a green light, therefore I can go. What happens when they have the they are trying to beat the other guy coming down the street? Now we're talking about a complete shutoff. Pedestrian safety, I've always said in this town, it's much safer to cross in the middle of the block where there is no crosswalk than it is at the crosswalks. Because if you watch what happens, people in the crosswalks are constantly being challenged by the car trying to turn into that crosswalk and onto Main Street. My concern when I first read this, and I was on vacation last week, and I got this, I don't know, Friday, I think I read the committee meetings, or Thursday, and I went, what? I wonder if they talked to the fire department. And the answer was no. Fire department hadn't been consulted. I wonder if they talked to the school district. And the answer was no, they haven't talked to the school district. What about WTA? WTA has to cross Main Street at 3rd Street. And a non-signalized intersection, they could sit there forever trying to get that break in the traffic to cross. I guess the answer right now is that it's broke, so we're going to try and fix it. I'm not really in favor of spending an awful lot of money through Transpo or through Herman Engineering to tell us that this isn't going to work. Now, if they've got some way of, and I appreciate what Brent had to say, those are the kinds of things that I'd like to see us pursue. Let's take some baby steps in this instead of the whole thing. It has come up before, and I really think it's actually more practical than this suggestion that we do one-ways on Main Street and Alder, and that there be an experiment to do one-way on Main Street and Alder. I don't know whether that'll work, and we would know in 30 days, but it certainly is not going to be as devastating as shutting all the signals off would be. That suggestion's never gone too far. Again, because we're all in a comfort zone. And the comfort zone is to have traffic control. And the final bit of information I'll throw out is, when we had a trouble getting from Douglas onto Main Street and Main Street onto Douglas, and we fixed that intersection, what did we do? We put a light up. Now we're talking about taking them down to create the problem that we solved on Douglas. I have a hard time with that.
Well, I think that backing off of this is a very wise idea right now. I do like the idea that Councilman Goodrich had about no left turns between certain designated times. I also would think that something that we could do that would greatly improve traffic flow down Main Street, eliminate left turns off of Main Street, period. Just do away with left turn lanes on Main Street. You watch those left turn lanes, and the first car drops in there, gets out across the crosswalk. Second car drops into that short, stubby little left turn lane, and his ass end is sticking out in the traffic, and he blocks traffic. And everything comes to a stop. So until that traffic coming the other way finally gets a break and that guy can turn, nobody's moving. Our left turn lanes are very short. What I'd like to see us at least investigate is, and if we're going to work with Transpo and the other traffic engineers, let's look at adopting the UPS model. Right turns only. UPS forbids its drivers to turn left. You can't make a left turn in a UPS truck. Get caught, your job. They spent millions of dollars studying the fact that left turns are incredibly wasteful of time and money and gas. So UPS drivers only turn right. And it works like a charm.
And they go around the block.
And they go around the block. And Mythbusters proved it to be true. Absolutely nailed it. Said it's absolutely true. It saves gas, it saves time, and it saves money. So I think we could at least investigate us as a city trying to do that. And I do agree with the fact that we've never given serious consideration to do what several people in this city have suggested years ago, and that's do one way westbound on Main and one way eastbound on Alder by turning the stop signs and making it just flow in a circle. And I don't think that it was even asked Transpo if they would look into that as an option. We tried to get that done, but I don't think they did they?
I think they reviewed it. I forget what the results were. It certainly wasn't the primary thing that they looked at.
I would certainly say that if we're going to have investigate somehow or other changing the pattern of lights, that we also should have them do some minor work on what would happen if we were one ways.
Yeah. Okay, Councilperson Mutchler.
First of all, Greg, thank you for the idea. I this is fascinating to me. And I'm trying to put my head around in a car. Would there be no signs? Would there be stop signs, or would there be yield signs at these intersections? What do we see as a driver? Just nothing, or would we actually see something to tell us I need to watch out?
It depends on whether you ask someone who's not a traffic engineer like me, or someone who is trained in this, like Janice and our other traffic engineers. My initial thought, again, from a layman standpoint, and simply looking at that video, was let's just take everything away, and that was just a rather impulsive thought initially. Thinking more through it, there's not only practical reasons, pedestrians and other issues, but also legal issues. It turns out that the controlling of intersections is a highly regulated industry from both the state and federal standpoint. In fact, even if we wanted to do this, the Bible, it's like a 5-inch thick, double-sided, that's it right there, that's the model traffic, whatever it is, it requires at the very least a 90-day public notification period, and there's also, perhaps more importantly from a regulatory standpoint, a requirement that a certified traffic engineer approve the alternative signalization or the lack of standard signalization. So while the idea in England in this one town, perhaps due to the unique geometry of the streets, was simply to remove all control whatsoever, it must be noted, too, that Europe has a much longer history in roundabouts and non-traffic control intersections. They also apparently are much, much less litigious than Americans. In fact, if you look at the picture of Pottingshead, you can almost picture a couple roundabouts where those roads come in. I mean, the geometry is pretty much there. It's almost like a vista in Washington where those roads come in at an angle. You can almost picture it someday, a roundabout there.
Just really old buildings.
Yeah. So while the original concept, again, from the video, was to remove all traffic controls, we've also talked about variants off that theme, flashing yellow, flashing red, peak period, regular lights, off-peak period, flashing yellow lights, not unlike some cities in California that have done. So right now I think what we're going to do is, as we mentioned, spend a little bit of time, model some of these variants as well as some of these other good ideas that have come forward. And I guess what I'd like to say just here is that I really would like to thank all the council members for being open to a new concept rather than dismissing it out of hand. It could very well be that this will not work in the variations we're talking about, but it has opened up and furthered the discussion about alternatives that could indeed aid our traffic in the future. So for that, I really do thank you.
Let me just follow up. You mentioned Vista, Washington. As I was looking at this, it reminded me of Vista, Washington, and I'm wondering if this is something we might consider trying at that Washington stop sign and make everything in that, because that's an odd thing, make all that yield for everybody.
Right.
And, well, as a solution.
As the council is aware, the city is has come to an agreement in principle, and we're waiting for the signed documentation for the city to purchase the home on the corner of Vista and Washington, which would free up a significant portion of land that could indeed allow us to modify the turn lane from Washington onto Vista and allow for perhaps more of a merging situation rather than that full stop intersection. So, yeah, that I think is a prime intersection, especially with our ability to obtain that land, for us to look at alternatives to just a traditional stop and go.
That's Person Goodrich. Two things. One is I was at a group meeting in Bellingham Saturday, and the topic of this came up, and I said, well, they were going to put bags over the lights, and they wanted to know if we were going to use paper or plastic. But what I was wondering, though, is I know we have people from the audience that came tonight. I was curious to see if anybody had comments or whatever to hear from them.
Council discussion. Okay. Council, and then I know you have two comments from citizens you wanted to enter in. One is Mr. Palmer. I think you all got the copy of Mr. Palmer's email. Mm-hmm. I guess his main comment was ridiculous.
Stupid.
It was ridiculous, too. And then, but a great call from a Mrs. Reiter, and she doesn't live in Ferndale, but she read it and studied the website, and said, you know, I've been in cities that have done this, and I really like it, but only if you take the money that you were going to spend on traffic lights and you have the flashing lights and you make the crosswalks lighted and wide and flashing lights, and then what you need is what you had talked about is the safe haven in the middle of the street. And she says, if you look on your video, I've watched your video, and that's, you know, you see the English children, well, they're safe because they get to the middle and then they can kind of wait and move around. So she says, I don't like lights. obviously, I guess I'll throw this out. She goes, I've only lived in America for a long time, and I think American drivers are stupid, so I don't know if they'll ever figure it out. And I said, well, where were you? And she goes, well, I actually grew up in England, and we figured it out. We would figure it out quicker than Americans. I go, well, okay. So that was her comment, but she wanted to spread it. She says, I could see it, but only if you really make it where pedestrians are your focus, which should be. Pedestrians should be your focus, rather than those stupid cars. So, you know, what you think of
it? I guess I'd add, too, that it's my understanding that back in the day when the very first traffic light came into the city, there was widespread opposition to that light, not unlike what we're hearing today on the idea of turning them on.
My father shared that. It's like, well, you know, everybody was against that first light. Thought it was going to destroy downtown Ferndale. Terrible, terrible.
Terrible, terrible.
So this is a great discussion, so it's fun to listen. So I'll go with maybe show of hands or whoever wants to stand up first and make a comment. Nobody? Anybody? Come on. Now. This is good.
Well, never say never.
Well, let's, you know, she says, okay, we're going to show her. We'll just take no comment? Come on now. We'd love to hear some comments. One back there.
I would like to make a comment.
Well, come on forward.
If you're going to talk.
Wait. We'll go name and then you can talk.
My name is Grace Cisneros. I live here in Ferndale. I'm definitely opposed to this thing, but one of the things that you might consider doing is having traffic pedestrians cross actually in the alleyway so you don't go in the lights. When you're turning left, like on 2nd to Main Street, I tell you, I've missed pedestrians just by this much because I can't see them. There's so much activity there. Take the pedestrians out of the street corners and in the middle in the alleyways. If you're going to have flashing lights, have them cross in the, you know, where the alleys come in to both sides. Maybe make that more of a pedestrian where you can cross. There's more visibility. It takes, then you, when you turn a left hand, you aren't fighting traffic and pedestrians to cross. And you have that on, by that Treasure House, and then you have it by Babes. So you have two pedestrian walkways that you could actually be very well lighted. Then there's no fighting to get the, got to turn left before the light changes. Or I got to turn, you know, whatever, right or left. But that, and then you have the safety. You can have a, create a little thing there for, I don't know, the kids. What were the kids walking or?
Is it like a safety island?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that might be, that's for pedestrians. I don't know about the cars, but, I mean, I do think that something should be done on Main Street because I absolutely hate it. And I'm glad we have this new, I mean, sort of like getting onto Portal Way, but when there's, the trains are also a pain, you know, there seems to be a lot of just terrible congestion in Ferndale that really does need to be addressed.
Any questions? Councilperson Metzler?
Thank you for speaking. I think an example of what you're talking about is in Bellingham on Cornwall between Holly and Magnolia, there's sort of a mid-block crosswalk with a, and it sticks out, so cars can't park, so you've got a nice, safe island there.
Yeah, but, you know, that might, because if pedestrians, we want pedestrians downtown, I mean, and to be able to be safe down there.
Good, thank you. Anyone else? Good discussion. Yes. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Wendy Lawrence, 6225 Argyle Street here in Ferndale. I'm all about engineering, and if you're going to do this, then I hope it is a well-thought-out plan and you have a test plan where you can measure your success. But I'll throw this idea out because it absolutely surprised me when I went to New Zealand for the first time, and I don't remember what city we were in. I think it was Auckland. They have a concept over there where at an intersection, all lanes of traffic are stopped and all pedestrians go at once, and they allow you to cross on a diagonal. So I don't know if your transpo engineers have this variability in their model, but that might be an interesting idea for you to model, is whether or not that solves the pedestrian issue in the left turn. Just a thought.
Yeah,
yeah, Wendy, they have that's done a lot in downtown San Francisco, too. You know, everybody comes to a stop, and then all the pedestrians just scatter. It's like a covey of quail. They're going everywhere. Diagonal,
some of that
back and forth. It's all over the place, and it works.
Anyone else from the audience? This is a conference? No? Nothing?
Okay. Moving on.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. Good discussion. So we'll continue this. So, Mel, we're not going to start it tomorrow then, according to you?
No, and my coffee shop buddies will be extremely happy to hear that we took no action. They basically told me not to bother to show up tomorrow morning if we did implement this, so there you go.
It is. I mean, talking to this Mrs. Reader or Writer, it is interesting. I mean, that she noticed that, you know, you don't respect pedestrians in roads here as opposed to where I've been before. Your system is your crosswalks are not very well defined, and people making that left. And so she says that's where I see it is. It's a danger when cars are trying to make the left and citizens are walking. And so we have some good points here, so I think we're moving forward. Councilperson Ingram?
You know, well, I will relate to you that I very nearly lost my darling wife to exactly that scenario in downtown Ferndale. She was crossing from the hair salon at 2nd, making the cross across 2nd. She had a white jacket on that you've probably seen her wearing a million times. And when she came home, there was dirt streaks across the jacket. Because a pickup truck flying through the intersection the other way turned left and literally brushed her back. If she'd have taken about one more step, I probably wouldn't have a girl.
So certainly good discussion. Okay, next up, capital projects.
All right, starting with the police department. The work continues. Right now, the footings have been poured for the additions, and so now you can actually see the outline of the building. And having looked at the plans for lo these many months only on paper, it's interesting to walk around the building and realize that, you know, this is going to be the sally port, and over here are the locker rooms and what have you. So it's progressing rather quickly. The contractor is still very aggressive and wanting to get this building buttoned up rather quickly to try to get all the work on the inside before the rain starts flowing. So we're working through a lot of the preliminary issues. Naturally, at the beginning of any construction project, there's always a large amount of activity at the very beginning when the contractor is asking for responses to specifics. You know, is this supposed to be on the top of this or the bottom of this? And so right now our architect and engineers are working through all those what's called RFIs, requests for information. But otherwise, the project continues rather well.
Whatever happened with the hillside to the White House? The determination?
The issue there was, for those that don't know, there's that row of pyramidalis that are pretty much on the property line that separates the police department site from the home on the corner. But those pyramidalis were not the issue, but rather on the hillside itself, there were some some shore pine trees that were literally in the way of the extension of the building. So we cut down the trees, removed the stumps, and then the question became the slope stability, because if you remember, the edge of the property slopes down towards the bottom of the of that slope where the pyramidalis is. And so MTC, which is our testing firm that comes in and tests the soil compaction, and they're very good at that. They've done studies. The issue was, given the height, I believe there's a 17-foot wall that's going to be the new exterior to the building. And so the issue was, did the removal of the stumps undermine the stability of the slope such that there needed to be extra either ecology blocks or some sort of a reinforcement on that slope to maintain the footings. It turns out that the soil compaction is still adequate, and so we don't need to put any ecology blocks or otherwise buffer that hillside. So that was something that was good. Talking about MTC, one thing that we did discover is on the backside of the new addition where the Sally Port and the other addition is towards the public works yard. Before we started the project, we had our geotechnical engineers, which are basically dirt engineers. They go out and they dig test holes around the property to determine the profile of the soil. So you can determine preliminarily up front whether the soil is suitable to actually hold the weight of the building so the building doesn't sink over time. And so while we did those potholes for the geotechnical work originally, when we came in and excavated the entire length of the building for the new footing, we found out that where they didn't dig, that was unsuitable soil. The soil there is a mixture of fill as well as native soils. As a result, we had to excavate out a strip of soil down rather deep and then bring back in suitable soils and have that compacted. And that was a bit of a surprise, but yet it's also quite common for the subsoil to be somewhat of a mystery. You never really know what's under the ground until you dig there. We knew that there was an abandoned water line, which they found, but we did not realize the unsuitability of a certain section of soil back there. But that's now been backfilled and compacted, and the footings have been put in. They're now getting ready to put in what's called the CMU, and it's rather ingenious. It's been around for quite a long time. I used it at a prior city I worked at. Normally, you would put wood boards for forms and then pour the concrete inside of it. This is literally a styrofoam form that has plastic cross members, and so you pick up a section and you stack them. And then you pour the concrete on the inside, and what you end up with is a concrete wall with insulation on both sides sandwiched already in it. And it's structural with the cross members, so you end up with the insulation and the wall all in one place. So the other day they were up there with a forklift moving around these somewhat lightweight but large piles of these forms. And what it really means is that these poured foundation walls are going to go up rather quickly once they start stacking this CMU forms around. And it does provide for a very stable and well-insulated product at the end. So I think in the next few weeks you're going to be seeing quite a bit of activity on the outside. On the inside, they are actually framing the walls for all of the new offices in the existing building. So you can actually walk through and see the hallways and the rooms, and it really is taking shape in the existing building. And once they get the exterior CMU walls up and pour the flooring, that's going to go up rather quickly as well. As I think most people will appreciate who's ever built a house, it is sometimes longer to finish the inside of the building than it is to frame and sheath the outside of the building. So they hope to be done with the building itself in February, which means that probably in the next 60 days or so they should have the walls and the roof on, and from the exterior you'll be able to see exactly what the footprint of the building will look like.
That's President Mutchler.
Yeah. I guess that would probably call it a change order, the excavation that we need to do, about how much that
right.
Run us.
I believe it's something like, I want to say 12,000 to 20,000. What it is when we bid the project, a lot of times you bid unit prices. That is, you bid for every yard of gravel, they bid so many dollars. And if you need more, you simply take that bid times the new amount. So it's one of those rather straightforward change orders because it's not a negotiated amount. It's simply a we need 10 units instead of one unit. So it's fairly straightforward.
And we have $500,000.
Yeah, we do have a healthy contingency. And again, getting out of the ground is always rife with uncertainty. In the industry, it's called differing site conditions. And that's just the way it is when you build pretty much anywhere.
And then I'd like to obviously know that we're adding our emergency operations center in there. And so last Friday we had our first kind of roundtable discussion. I'll bring the police chief up to kind of do a review of that meeting. Chief, you want to review our meeting last Friday?
Good evening. We're trying to make this building state-of-the-art. The EOC also will be state-of-the-art. Since the city interacts immediately with the county, we brought county officials in, as well as some private consultants. We have the backbone of the EOC already in place, thanks to the federal government, and that is our communications. So what we're looking at now is how to best configure the building up front, and secondly, how to maintain a state of readiness so that whatever catastrophe befalls us, the plan will be an all-hazards plan that will allow the city to maintain a continuation of business with each staff member having a function and knowing where in the plan he is to report and what duty he is to perform. And we have wonderful people here in the audience as well that have given us their time to give us advice on this topic. So I think we're very much in front of this design element.
Great. Okay. Other project updates. Kay, do you want to do one on the water line?
Progress is going forward very, very well. They're on schedule. The road closure, I know everybody was very concerned about that. Imhoff Road was closed on Wednesday. I have not heard any problems with that so far. To this point, the contractor has the waterline installation. The project was broken into two parts, basically the upper part and the lower part. They've done that first half. They've run the water line from the shop well site, which is behind the new PD. And they've run that to connected it to the Douglas Well site, and then the first portion of the T down Imhoff Road, basically to where Jim Bospek's property is, if you're aware of that, about 500 feet south of the intersection. That pipe's all been installed. Pipe's been tested for pressure and bacteria. It's passed. The contractor today was finishing up doing some asphalt patching and repair. They have laid out the 18-inch pipe along Imhoff Road, and they plan on starting that installation tomorrow. And now that we're out of the areas where, you know, there's houses and different services, either water, telephone, underground services, the installation will go fairly quickly. So.
Questions for Kay? Councilperson Goodrich?
The shop well, the line comes through PD, across Main Street, mm-hmm. down Douglas. And then did you say that it goes to the new well site, or does it come turn and go down Imhoff and then tie in to the line coming from the new well?
I kind of refer to it as a J. So the two tops of the capital J, you know, are the two lines that feed into the line at Imhoff. So you've got the well site at the shop. Like you said, it goes down Douglas Road towards Imhoff, and then that's where it tees. The Douglas Well site then heads east on Douglas and then to Imhoff, where everything converges. The pipe gets larger. Those two lines in between the two wells are 12-inch, and then it changes to 16. And then in the flats there where we're starting now, it's increased in size to 18-inch pipe. So
now there was a talk a long time ago, I remember, that if we needed to add another well at Douglas, is the pipe that's in the ground from Douglas to Imhoff big enough to handle another well?
I think Janice would like to speak to that.
That's correct. We did upsize that pipe to accommodate that, adding an additional well.
Okay, anything else?
Nothing.
Okay.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilperson Ingram?
Katie.
Hey, Katie.
You got a tape measure in your purse?
I do in my purse, but my purse is in my car.
Oh, well, that's okay. So, I want to measure those two windows. I'm going down and buying drapes for them.
Oh, you saw me squinting? Oh.
Well, you're married to him. Give him the tape measure. Any other capital project updates?
Sidewalk?
Oh. Okay, the sidewalk projects. Yes, we're getting close. So we finally obtained all of our for the environmental approvals and permits. So we just got word on that, and then we're waiting on the funding approval. And so it's been a little bit of a slow process, but we are getting close. So we've had to kind of work around people being on vacation and waiting for them to get back to sign off on paperwork, but we're getting close. And actually, one change, we are combining both of the projects, and we'll just be bidding it as one rather than the two separate ones. And so hopefully then that'll get it through a little bit quicker.
One contractor for both.
Okay. So we had to work with the DOT on that. And so said at this point, we just go ahead and combine the two projects and then just bid it.
Is that still small work cost for that?
No.
It takes you about?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but we're working on getting approval to advertise just for the 2 weeks versus the three. So that really, I mean, when you go small works versus the regular, you're just kind of talking about that, just that extra advertising. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting.
One minor thing on the new library project, our new civil engineer has identified something that we might want to consider when we go to construction that would actually lower our site costs. If you remember, the new entrance to the library next to City Hall will be just on the other side of the pizza annex. And from the street, it drops down to the site. And if you notice, on both sides of the pizza annex, there's an exterior stairway that goes down to the basement. Originally, the thought was that because of that stairway and because of the grade difference, we would need to put in a retaining wall and railings to separate the driveway from that exterior stairwell on the, I guess it'd be the north side, the west side of the building. They're suggesting, and when we actually go to construction, this is something that we're going to be doing, is actually the idea would be to close off waterproof and fill in that stairwell on the west side.
We've got interior access.
We have interior access, and we would still have the exterior access from the City Hall side of the building. That would really cut down on a lot of the costs and really make the project, I think, aesthetically a little better. So that's just something that was identified. It'll be rolled into when we actually do bid this construction project in the future as a revision to the original site plan. But that was something that was picked up by them and suggested, and I think it's actually going to save us a lot of time and trouble in the long run.
Okay. Any other project updates? No? Okay. On to mayor reports. Council, next Tuesday at 6 p.m., you're invited. It'll be my second Pioneer Park stakeholders meeting. We have some issues at Pioneer Park that I want all the stakeholders to kind of discuss. So 6 p.m. at City Hall if you'd like to show up. And we still have an opening on the Planning Commission.
Is that not...
That's the following week.
Yeah. Got it. Heritage Society will be invited to this meeting, but
right.
No Society.
I thought.
No, we still have some. We have some. Anyway,
yeah.
You can come and see the issues that night. We have a Planning Commission opening. We have two applicants that turned in that seem to be quality individuals, but we're still looking for more. We'd like to close that opening pretty soon, so if anyone's wants to join the Planning Commission.
Do you have a closing date, Mayor, so we know?
We haven't done a closing date.
I think that it was gosh, is it this week, actually? Because it was like 60 days or 45 days.
Our initial closing date on the advertisement itself was August 5th.
Our advertising.
And one missed that, so we're still a set. There you go. Okay, that's it for mayor reports. Council reports. Councilperson Goodrich?
A couple of things from the EDC that came up this week that I thought was kind of interesting. One of them was the fact that over 90% of the businesses in Whatcom County have 20 or fewer employees. I thought that was kind of an interesting. Most of them were small businesses in Whatcom County. The other thing that came up was Canadians coming down here and doing their presence in, you know, Ferndale. I know we were talking about, you know, us being a place for them to come and have the U.S. presence. One of the things that they brought up was that they are talking about, I forgot which organization that was there of the other folks that brought it up, about making sure that the businesses have their immigration issues.
Oh, that was Tom Doerr's group.
Tom Doerr, yeah.
Center for Economic Vitality through Western Washington University.
Because I didn't realize it, but you're limited to the number of times you can come across the border if you don't have your immigration things. And so they brought up an example of a husband and wife that were talking about putting a business here, and then all of a sudden they got stopped at the border, and she couldn't come across anymore because she's exceeded her number of trips. And so they said that that's something that when any of the Canadians come down here that they talk to, they said, you know, who's your immigration attorney? To make sure that they have all that squared away so that that you don't get stopped at the border. So that was something, a couple of things that I learned that at the EDC meeting I thought were kind of interesting.
Councilperson Ingram?
Yeah, if anybody in the audience or on staff wants to come up on Wednesday to the fair and get up there between about 9 o'clock and 1:30, the mayor will be taking your order at the Boys and Girls Club food booth. I'll be slinging hash on a griddle. Kathy will be doing cash register. Kelly will be doing wrap and roll thing or something like that. Mel's going to be the fry master. And yeah, come on up. We'll feed you.
That's the main pavilion.
That's in the display, or what do they call it? The pavilion of the display hall, or yeah.
Councilperson Hanson.
Street Fair is the 26th and 27th.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, there will be a hot dog booth right out here in the middle of the street. I believe, is Jason still doing the...
Just contact me.
Okay. If you want to work, contact
Guy.
Guy. And we'll be operating shifts on Friday night and all day Saturday.
Great. Councilperson Mutchler?
Yeah, this is a matter that came up at the Public Health and Neighborhood Services meeting regarding the possibility of a future Ferndale pool. And I don't remember if this came up at council or it's just been a committee meeting, but the council member Zimmerman, who represents the pool group, which is now an official 501c3 committee.
They don't have it yet.
I heard that they do.
Well, they've been set for 5 years.
They did list on their presentation provided that an EIN, so it appears they may have it.
Well, I think they just recently got it.
An employee identification number is not a 501c3. That's the Downtown Association has an EIN, but they do not have 501c3 yet. And the pool committee has not had a 501c3 all along, even though they've advertised that they do. I don't know that report that was put out was said in preparation for.
Yeah.
So unless they've just received it, they don't have it.
And that was my impression that they
had. I thought they had just gotten it within the last couple of months.
That could be.
Yeah.
So they've not had it up to this point, though. So.
Well, we certainly need demonstration of that. But the point is that they've requested that the city provide a place for a pool, and they've named a spot, which I think is at 10 or 20 acres of the biosolids field out there by the river. I think it's the council needs to say yes or no, or yes if you do this kind of a thing. I think a response to any community committee like this is important, especially since like pool
as infeasible as it is, might be possible.
Point of order, I think that Councilperson Zimmerman should probably, I mean, he wanted to do it tonight, but he went on vacation. He would like to do a presentation and have it for discussion to the council before you go forward.
Exactly. Well, my point in bringing up tonight, and I told Mr. Taylor I'd bring up tonight, is that I think we should be thinking about questions to ask Lloyd so we're not blindsided by it, that what are the things that we need from them before we can even think about doing something like this? That was my point of bringing it up tonight.
I know on research that I did after that meeting that he mentioned one of his major fundraisers would be the Gates Foundation, and the Gates Foundation does not fund pools of any kind, nor do they have any indication of funding pools at any time. They did say they'd like to see a grant application for our library, but they said we've never funded pools.
And we were also going to look at what does it cost to replace our current biosolids field, those types of things. To price that. I mean, I'm finding the way. I think a response is appropriate. It's yes or no, or yes if these things are met. I think this out of it's the proper thing to do.
Great. Any other council reports? Okay, department reports. 7:30. This is cool. City administration.
Nothing.
Planning.
Just to give you an update, Janice and I have been working with the Parks Board on updating the park plan. As you know, because the county council last week voted to approve decreasing our UGA, as council had recommended, that was 7-0 vote, we now have about 400 less acres in which to put parks. So we are going to be changing our level of service to reflect that. Unfortunately, we need to change the level of service rather than just slashing as much as we'd like to. But the upshot is... we will also be able to reassess the manner in which we calculate the impact fee, and there are opportunities for it to go up, stay the same, or even go down fairly significantly. So we're going to take it through Parks Board, then Planning Commission, and then to Council.
Great. Public Works. Please. Clerk.
Because I am a geek, I should let you know that according to GuideStar.com, which tracks nonprofits, the Ferndale Double Dome does have nonprofit status currently as of 2011. Related to the clerk's office. today we received contractual paperwork, a licensing agreement from the city of Lakewood, Washington, finally, after months ago I let you know that we were working on getting a public records request tracking software for free, which will save us about $8,000 to $12,000 approximately. We have to sign the licensing agreement, and once we do that, they will provide us with the software and the manual how to use it. It's completely free to all local jurisdictions interested, and we probably are going to be pretty close to the first ones who get it, so that I'm pretty excited to be able to implement something that will not cost Ferndale taxpayers anything at all.
Okay. Is that only because you're a geek or because you're a good clerk?
I'm a geek. I'll leave it up to everybody else. Not to get the clerk back.
Okay, good. Council, I would entertain a motion to
so
adjourn. Second? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Is that my second then?
Yeah, I saw him now. He moved his lips. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Approved.
Sam? Taylor?
Sam, was that a... Is that a 501c3 or is it one of the other classifications?
It's just identified
as a nonprofit. The reason I say that, the reason I say that is,
I don't think they're a C3.
No, I'm going to say that's. I think they're a C something. Right in the regulations, not for athletic facility.
I think they're a C something else.
Yeah, C6 maybe. Yeah.
Five might be.
What's that?
I think five is
here. Okay. Good. Do you want to talk to me?
Sure.
I mean, Argyles and Stripes, I mean, those are the kind of things that we need on TV.
Obviously, we came out of a conversation that was just a good discussion. It just allowed us to have more ideas.
Exactly.
My point
is, 5 years you're saying we're not five. I mean, you pulled my brochure. He had about 5 years ago. He says we're a 501c3.
No, I know, I don't. He said it all.
I don't think he's going to get 501c3. I think he'll probably get a C6.
Sure.
501c3 is very specific athletic. facilities are not to be included.
I wonder how many people have given donations and claimed it as a charitable.
How about?
Well, there's a little, clause in the IRS. You give donation in good faith, and the organization behaves like a charitable organization, then you can take that off your
list. Oh, sure.
So if you don't have to, in order to make that a legal donation, you don't have to get them to prove their 501c3 status.
Hey, nice meeting. What are you okay with for? Oh, don't tell. You can't talk to me about DOT. No one in the journalism community likes DOT chants. They are hated.
Recordings.